At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're trying.
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the Academy Award-winning film The Fugitive. Starring Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones, The Fugitive is a story about a man wrongly convicted of the murder of his wife and his quest to find the least hinky people in Chicago. Today we are joined by special guest David from the Lorehounds. And with me, as always, to discuss this movie is Dr. Anthony LaDon.
Welcome, David.
Thank you. Great to be here. I'm honored to be part of the Bacon Wrap season.
Do you know that my intros always pay tribute to The Fugitive? When I say Dr. Anthony LaDon, I try to say it like Tommy Lee Jones going, your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball.
I did not know that.
Dr. LaDon, I'm giving a speech here.
That would be good.
My friend.
Dr. LaDon is not feeling so well.
I mean, I'm not saying that you're wrong to not like it, but I find it interesting that the reviews are generally positive, uh-huh. But you sort of said, I've seen some positive reviews. As uh-huh. if already, like you're questioning the authenticity of the reviews uh-huh. that are out there.
Exactly.
I was like, Rotten Tomatoes is the Epstein list of reviews.
Steve, the file is on my desk. I'm reviewing it.
I'm looking at it right now.
It's ready to go.
And the good news is it's gone and it never was.
I feel like it's very anti-bald, and I find that offensive.
Is the Lex Luthor character not bald? I'm not tracking Superman at all.
Lex Luthor historically is bald, but they've usually found a way to allow Gene Hackman to keep his hair.
Exactly.
Or Kevin Spacey to, you know, keep his hair. Or, you know, there's usually a wig involved, which makes me feel a little bit better about it. But this one, just full bald all the time, you know, kind of going for a Jeff Bezos look.
The wig is to Lex Luthor as the glasses are to Superman.
Perfect. Perfect.
Like, no, that's not Lex Luthor. That's Gene Hackman, played by Kevin Spacey.
Oh, goodness. Gene Hackman, loosely attached to The Fugitive, which we're talking about today.
Yep, indeed, he is.
We just had a Gene Hackman movie fest for our 11Z's coverage, and we
love me some Gene. So this movie, The Fugitive, he was considered for the Harrison Ford role.
No, I thought he was considered for the Tommy Lee Jones, the Gerard.
And then he was considered for the other role. He was considered for both roles. For this film.
So he was going to have a wig when he was Harrison Ford's character, and he'd be bald when he was Tommy Lee Jones' character. Is that how it was going to work?
In either case, he would have had the Gene Hackman voice. Did he ever do a different voice? He's one of these great actors who, you know,
no.
Everyone loves him. Did he ever do a voice?
No. I don't think so.
To his credit.
Well, in Enemy of the State, he voiced Will Smith's character.
He did both sides.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Will Smith was in that one. For some reason, he was too nervous.
Steve, what is the coolest thing you've ever done with Velcro?
The coolest thing I've ever done with Velcro?
Mm-hmm.
Guess wore Spider-Man shoes when I was little.
Very good. All right, same question to you, David.
I think it had something to do involving fireworks and the pre-4th of July teenage hijinks.
Say more.
I'm trying to, it's like, it's fuzzy.
Because I will do it as an adult.
Yeah.
It was fuzzy, but it was something about creating some sort of handheld bottle rocket launcher, like a pistol grip bottle rocket launcher thing.
I can't believe I didn't think of this. This is fantastic.
I was telling a story about one of Anthony's and my, like we used to work in the fireworks stands, the safe and sane one. And, you know, so nothing crazy. But then some guy told us about the Killer Bees firework, mm-hmm. where they had little, like these little paper bees.
Used to get the best tips from.
And
from
so they were, they were glued to the side or to the sides of this thing. So you'd have the center fountain and then these little guys would shoot off their little individual killer bees. And the guy said, hey, what you want to do is you want to clip those bee wings. You want to clip those wings. And then so we said, hey, all right, this is going to be really fun. I mean, kind of a little bit of pomp and circumstance. We were in a neighborhood that I had never been to before.
Okay. And this is actually an important detail to me. The killer bee has around the perimeter of the cylinder tiny little fireworks, about 12, that will shoot off or shoot up. But what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to take a razor blade.
You're not supposed to. And you're not supposed to.
According to the tip I got, you're supposed to take a razor blade and cut the paper that holds it on the side just slightly. It's not glued. It's just held on by a thin bit of paper. But if you use the
picture online.
Just a tiny little bit of the paper. Continue, Steve.
And I believe you kind of had a gather round all ye children moment to let people know this is gonna be a cool thing that's gonna happen here, and it was. I mean, that thing lit off, and that fountain did what the fountain did, and then those bees took off like they departed from their base, and they were beelining.
Couple direct hits.
Beelining. One direction right into a child's sternum.
You know, our generation was a one-time thing. We don't. They don't let us do that. Is even the killer bees? Are you? Is that available in stores?
I don't
anymore?
Think so. I don't.
That's
I
like one of those.
We're all banned out here.
All right. Well, let me give you a little tip on the border of Michigan and Indiana. All right, so I just went across this border recently, right around the place that The Fugitive is filmed. And when you go across this border, you'll see right at the border, all of the illegal fireworks in Michigan are legal in Indiana. Right. But all of the marijuana that is legal in Michigan is illegal in Indiana. And so they push these two things together right at the border. And what I'm thinking is, why don't you people get together? Because what would be better than combining both of these things and join both at the same time?
The illicitness of the artificial geographical boundary is what makes it a special thing. Because if you had a bar and a VFW post, like, so what? Like, it, mm-hmm. you know, that makes sense. It's not special. But that you're crossing the border from one to the other, I think that somehow makes it something different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Coolest thing I've ever done with Velcro involved a knife set that I had, which I was very happy about it. And it's important that you're using load-bearing Velcro.
Okay.
Are you familiar with load-bearing Velcro?
I didn't know that there was a distinction. I mean, I'm certainly...
It's really important. And I want you... This is important for this film because the key distinction between the federal agents and the local policemen is really the Velcro technology.
Mm. Tommy Lee Jones definitely has a Velcro moment in the tunnel.
And not only that, his whole team's got a Velcro. Mm-hmm. And like he's got Velcro.
Yeah, that's right.
He's walking up to the crime scene. They're going to question him. Velcro... flips it down. Hey, look at that badge.
Yep, that's true.
I'm going to take over. And then, of course, they've got the scene where the Velcro's on their back. Yep. And I remember watching this in 93 thinking, damn it, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen 100%. Anyone do with Velcro. 100%.
Well, the thing, too, about the Velcro, so clearly that is not load-bearing Velcro because it would take so many pulls. So the thing is about it is, like, one, it shows their experience. As officers, that they can usually get it in one tug. Because the better the Velcro, you know, the better the seal, right? Your hooks are doing what they're supposed to do. So that to get it in one yank, I mean, that it demonstrates a certain adeptness in their craft.
There's a whole week at the
at academy where they
at the cadet, you know, yeah. at the cadet level, where you have to master the Velcro, and a lot of people just don't make it past that.
There's a lot of deleted scenes where the Chicago PD are trying to unvelcro something, and they're comically struggling mightily to try to demonstrate the difference between the two units.
I do want to talk about the difference between police officers in this movie, but before we do, I'm kind of curious, Steve, you chose this film because of Tommy Lee.
True.
So I thought I'd give you a little bit of room to talk just about why you chose the movie.
Sure, because it was coming down to, it's interesting, it was coming down to two. I mean, obviously, Tommy Lee Jones is the reason why we're here, by virtue of No Country for Old Men. And I was actually going between two Tommy Lee Jones joints that were both directed by Andrew Davis, which would be The Fugitive and Under Siege.
Wait, and, you said the Seagal one?
Yeah. And, okay. And oof. Don't you woof? That's the best. It's the best Seagal. It probably put Tommy Lee Jones back on the map more so, like giving runway for this kind of attention on The Fugitive.
That's the one where he was the ship's cook on a battleship or something on the air. Or
Seagal,
Seagal was.
Busey in it. I mean, come on, this thing's amazing. And so
peak
Seagal's making bouillabaisse. Is that what he's doing?
I believe so. It was really hard for me to not pick this. Any of our, you know, all, you know, our three fans would know this is, that would be much more on brand for me. But my relationship with The Fugitive made it so that I wanted to talk with Anthony specifically about this, just because I have a feeling that this movie was a pretty 93. You know, we're what, seniors in high school, so this is like, we're kind of in that we want to be entertained, but we also are like, you know, kind of 1 foot into like movies that might matter a little bit more. And this one kind of did in a way, like, because it was, you know, it was heavy action, but it was also like, this was a big deal. This is a pretty large film for 93, and to be as critically acclaimed as it was commercially successful is kind of a unique situation, at least at this time. So I've seen this movie, I don't know, dozens of times. I always have the same problems with it every time I watch it, and I always enjoy the same parts every time I watch it. It's a little surprising to me how many Academy Awards it was nominated for.
And it won one of them.
Yeah, one of them, and it's definitely, I mean, it's definitely good. I mean, it's definitely a good film, but it's one of those movies where the more I watch it, the more formulaic it becomes. But I love every bit of that formula. I mean, this is, you know, when we get to the trope questions, I mean, this is rife, and it's kind of interesting how there's a lot of things that don't feel especially new. But they're presented I think the pacing is so good that it's, you just sort of are on the ride the whole time.
How close in proximity would you put this movie to The Usual Suspects in terms of its, I don't want to say it's not its heel turn, but its plot twist in its formulation of the reveal of the mystery?
I would say that it's lesser than,
okay.
Because I think there was so much more with The Usual Suspects. You're traveling along with the plot twist, like almost, you know, like you're like hand in hand with it. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, I've been holding my hands with the devil the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, it's like, you know, something's up. And I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, that accent's enough for me to already be like, I don't think so.
The good doctor.
Richard Charles Nichols. he's Peter Lorre-ing all over the place.
I think you're right about that, because I think that there's something about the Dutch accent that's good for this particular role, because it's not quite German. So you think, well, this guy actually might be good. But then when he turns out to be bad, you're like, oh, yeah, of course. That was what it was supposed to be all along. That guy kind of sounds a little bit like a German, right? So it's right on
German
the border there.
Or indeterminately European.
Right.
I don't know. It sounds German enough.
Okay.
Yeah, he works on the Death Star.
I thought they had British, but anyway.
So he, well, it's also, it's not just the voice. It's the way that he constantly tucks his chin down and then raises his eyes to the top of his eye sockets to give you a very condescending, no, and you'll never find him. And it's like, ugh. And yeah, no bad guy in this movie doesn't look like a bad guy, by the way.
And he's so effusive whenever Richard connects with him.
Well, right. On top of that, he's honest. He's honest with the federal agents. He's like, all right, fine, I'll tell you. I gave him money, and I wouldn't tell you where he was if I knew. And he's too smart for you. I saw him this morning, and I don't mind just telling you. All my cards are on the table. And so he just comes off as this guy thinks that his shit does not stink, but he's not going to lie, right? And of course, that court sort of, you feel even more betrayed toward the end when you realize that it is.
Well, and it does make it more, it's actually more diabolical, shows that there's a less of a, I just kind of caught up in the whole thing. Like, it shows there's a premeditation to this whole entire process. And then so for him to be like, well, I'm going to be honest with the cops about things like that. It's like, that's a very clever way to sort of get off the scent a little bit. Like, yeah, people are suspicious, but like, if you just told them that you saw them, then it doesn't seem like you're not automatically thinking you're concealing something, because it's like, well, he's cooperating. And so it's a very, very interesting. And then in retrospect too, it's like, okay, well, if I kind of tell you where Richard is, then maybe you'll find him too. And that's fine too.
David, you're a big fan of this movie. I'll give you a little bit of room to cook on it.
I didn't really think about the Velcro aspect, but now going back to it, when Tommy Lee Jones does that, that like solidified him in our minds as, oh, who's this guy, right? When he pulls out his gun in the tunnel. And then all his one-liners and just his general being, it was a phenomenal film at the time. And then the pacing and the action and the stunts, and that it's, you know, one of the questions that you always ask is like, who is this movie for? This is a movie for those of us who consumed a steady diet of Under Siege and Die Hard and Stallone and Schwarzenegger and just that whole, you know, and Aliens and RoboCop and all of this sort of action stuff, but in a little bit more sophisticated level. Like, we've grown up, we survived, we made it to the 90s out of the 80s. And then it's like this interesting crossover film because of the original television series, right? That this is this generational crossover. So you could get whatever, what do they call it? The 4X or something like that. You could get multiple quadrants of audience members into this movie. You could get an older generation that saw it on television. And then you could get this younger generation like us who just eat it up.
Have you ever pulled up the TV series?
I have not. I thought about trying to jump into it for this, but yeah, timing.
Steve, have you ever pulled that up?
No.
Neither have I. Now, it's interesting because we all know that it's based on a television series. And you know, it may be the best film ever made as a TV, you know, adaptation from a TV show. But it's never been anything that we've decided that it's worth our time to go look at. And I do think that it is one of these things that allowed my father to appreciate it on a different level. Because in 93, I was kind of already a movie snob. And Steve, of course, he was sort of my anchor to the popcorn world. And this is sort of before I started to appreciate movies like Big Trouble in Little China on that level. And so I thought...
I need to interject because you invoked Big Trouble in Little China.
Okay.
I'm working on this theory. I've got a kind of a proto blog post in process. But Steve said some stuff on your guys' coverage about that made me start thinking... And I trying to design a criteria of what that describes a perfect movie or a movie that is a perfect movie. And I think Big Trouble in Little China is a perfect movie.
Yes. Good.
Sorry, back to you.
I thought there would be more. I thought there would be more. I'll wait for the blog post.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is amazing.
I guess what I was trying to say before is that this is one of those movies that my dad and I both appreciated, even though I was becoming a movie snob, because even though I wasn't really giving action movies like this a second look, this movie is so good on so many levels. Mm. Just technically, and the action's compelling, but the acting is also compelling. And because of that, it's one of these rare movies that I think both my father and I both liked at the same time. And Hunt for October would be another example of this.
I think this goes to my theory that it's this generationally crossover movie.
Yeah. So I think you're right about that. I think it's one of these things where my dad could enjoy it on one level and I could enjoy it on a different level.
Yep.
And we could just really enjoy it together. And this is one of the rare, maybe one of the rare action movies that has a bit of, cinematic heft to it.
Mm-hmm. Something came to mind, too, about the action movie criteria things. This has a rooftop fight scene. It has a cat and mouse in an industrial space. And it's got some derring do action. So, yeah, I mean, it ticks so many boxes within that 80s era genre action movie.
And shooting from a helicopter almost just automatically. Does it, right?
Oh, and ascending action, and you got spotlights. And
exactly.
You got hunting dogs, and you got a train wreck. I mean, it's got a grand hotel at the end where there's a bunch of, there's actually an in-room audience to see him reveal the big Provasic secret.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough.
You actually... United.
You have to go all the way down to the fifth floor to the laundry room to actually have the punch out scene.
Right.
So it's structured like an action movie. I mean, there's no question about that, right? But for some reason, this sort of elevates beyond the genre.
Right.
It's a trick, and I think that's one of the things that really struck me on this rewatch was how much of it, and this is where I talk about formula, falls into action tropes at the end. I mean, it's kind of throughout, but like, it's an odd ending to a movie like this in many ways, because it's like there's nothing about Charles Nichols up to this point that gives you the sense that this guy can fight, and he fights quite a bit.
I was watching this with my daughter, and I was like, man, these doctors really know how to throw a punch, man.
These surgeons, like they can bust chairs on each other, and also Harrison Ford can take a chair to the back. I mean, these surgeons are tough as nails. And I mean, he uses an I-beam at one point to knock a guy out. I mean, it's like, it's relentless. And it's like, it's a little odd. Like the rooftop fight scene is like, I'm like, this is just, I guess I won't say I had a problem because I did enjoy it. But then I'm like, wow, I've been watching an action movie all these years, you know, because I'll be honest, I usually, when I rewatch The Fugitive, I rarely finish it. It's sort of like Anthony has movies that we talked about, like even like he likes to have like a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in the background, because like it's just, you know, it's moments of just
good company, right?
Exactly. So me, The Fugitive is good. It's great company up until a point, and then I'm like I can always leave it, and I usually always leave it. I do like the ballroom scene because I love the Richard, I'm in the middle of a speech, you know what I'm saying? And then he just goes off and everyone just like clutching their pearls as there's this wonderful exposition about RDU-90 and Provasic and Devlin McGregor. I mean, wonderful words to say. So, I mean,
Devlin McGregor is perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
The Devlin McGregor and Max Devlin. And it's just this, it's this great sequel. But then the fight scene, I'm always like, I mean, I guess, you know, it's like there's so much you could have still done with like, cause like the idea that the Chicago PD wants to like, you know, shoot to kill but I don't know, the fight between Nichols and Kimball is just something I feel like nothing up into that point was saying I wanted that.
can I just quickly but, back on the Harrison Ford thing. I forget what your other question was, Anthony, but I had this
I
thought.
I think Harrison Ford is the best actor who had a popular action figure made of him.
Oh, I didn't realize he had an action. I mean, obviously a Han Solo.
Absolutely. And you know, Indiana Jones. But,
sure. Yeah,
you know,
usually
these action figure stars are a particular kind of actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not the kind of actor who's going to win an Oscar. I think he's the best of both worlds.
I see what you're
saying. And I think, this may be controversial, I think that when he's being interrogated by the police at the beginning, I think that may be some of the best acting of his entire career, right?
We're going to disagree on this.
I think it's fantastic. I think he's processing his grief.
Mm-hmm.
He's upset that he's even being accused. He's trying to recall this, you know, the final moments of his wife's life. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's his worst acting in the film.
Oh no.
Hands down, it's the worst acting in the film sequence. But his acting in that interrogation scene is about as authentic as the dummy that goes falling off.
I love it. I love it every time.
Are you suggesting I crushed your skull? You find that man. He took everything from me. Oh!
I want you to know that you mimicking that just now brought me to tears. That's how much I love that scene.
But is
he had a mechanical... arm.
You find this man.
You find him. Oh.
Is Richard Kimble, though, a bit of a Gary Sue?
For who?
For I don't know who. I don't know the writer. Exactly, for him. I mean, he has a perfect dad bod. He has a beautiful, intelligent, accomplished wife. He's the white savior doctor who is,
he's a superhero. Let's just put it that way.
He saves the kid, right? Yeah.
He's a superhero. He can jump off a dam and then the next day, like...
He did a Peter Pan off this dam.
He can save kids' lives. He can flirt a little bit with some of the doctors at the hospital, even though he was just accused of killing his wife.
Lesbian doctor.
He cleaned.
He's such a superhero. He's going to make Jane Lynch weaken the knees.
And Julianna Moore. You know, she would have.
I do want to talk a little bit about one scene in particular, and this relates to the court case against him, right? The legal case against him. He's accused of murdering his wife, and part of this is pinned on this 911 phone call, and I'm going to play a little bit of it for you right now.
Ma'am, is your attacker still in the house? Ma'am?
Richard?
Ma'am?
Richard? He's trying to kill me.
Okay, right now, you see a gloved hand hang up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
That gloved hand has to be the one-armed man, right?
Right.
Right? That's not Richard Kimble who just hung up the phone.
Because it's like a glove to keep your fingerprints off.
Yeah, that's the dude who just killed her, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, why is he hanging out letting her make a phone call?
I know. That bugs me. Because it's such an important plot device that she says Richard and then there's this opportunity for misunderstanding. But like, is he just sitting there going, well, maybe she will do that?
I mean, that's the other thing about it. I was thinking, like, is he allowing this phone call to happen because he knows that she's going to call out her husband's name? It's impossible. It's impossible.
Right. Well, this goes to my theory that Sykes is the worst assassin. He's a complete...
he got distracted.
And he didn't even finish the job. Doesn't he have a gun? When he's fighting with Kimble?
I mean, he's there to kill Kimble, not the wife, right? And so it could be that when Kimble comes in the room, he hides or something thinking, okay, maybe I'll be able to attack him from behind
An easy time to do that would be when he's down there with his wife. Just shoot him.
Right.
So
maybe he put the gun in the wrong hand and realized, I can't pull a trigger. I have one arm.
So that really bugs me a lot because it's such a crucial point of the story.
It's a big flaw. I think
it's a huge flaw.
Here's the thing. The more I watch this movie, the more it's like, this is why I do believe, going back to that statement I made earlier, and like you guys are talking about the action, this, it's kind of a trick. There's a lot of tricks in this movie.
Totally.
Totally. And I think the trick is, this is where Andrew Davis deserves a lot of credit. He makes this action movie where there's all these things, and the pacing is such that it doesn't really allow you to spend a lot of time on that. You know, it isn't until like further rewatches that you're like, whoa, hold on a second here. You know, like, this seems like, wait, there was a phone call from Richard's cell phone to Sykes, and they just now decided to look into this, you know, like, you know, that, because that's a part where I'm like, for real? Well, you mean to tell me?
Why didn't they do a little bit of investigation about prosthetic arms? Like,
well, especially because it's like in the night, like the very night that this happened, you think that phone record, you would go through all of it. Yeah. Right. I mean, once you go through, like, oh, well, here's one he's never made before. Okay. Well, that's an outlier. Oh, it happens to be to a one-armed man. Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that has anything to do with his alibi.
The cops in this, man, the Chicago PD, is not painted in a very positive light in this particular film.
Which is an interesting move, because I think that this movie does a couple things different, like, which I like, is like they flip some of the tropes. Like in this case, it's you know, and you see it. I mean, this is, you know, different movies do it differently. Like, it is interesting to see the feds are the ones, right? Like normally it's like sort of the local cops are the ones that are like going to be a little bit more in tune with everything. And the feds are like when you just look at a Die Hard, for example, right? Like it's the FBI is like so detached, and they are just like willy-nilly.
Yeah.
They're the ones who will just kill at will, and they are not interested in all the details. They just got to get this thing done. Whereas now it's the other way, right? It's an interesting, element that the Chicago PD, because like they're protecting the Chicago legal system and the Justice Department as well, and all of them.
And something that struck me too was that these were federal marshals that don't look like militarized RoboCops.
Mm-hmm. They were more folksy.
And if this were made now, we'd have tactical teams with helmets, looking like a raid at a Home Depot kind of stuff, you know?
I want to commend whoever was doing costuming for this movie. Whoever is doing costuming for this movie just had a lot of fun. I mean, these federal marshals, they're wearing some very interesting clothing.
Stylish.
Yeah, they're trying on different styles. They're wearing suspenders. They're wearing
Tommy
sweater
Lee
vests.
Jeans don't leave a lot to the imagination.
Did Tommy Lee Jones, not only is this a breakout role for him, but did he popularize the sport coat tie jeans look?
If he did, I use it every day. When I was in high school, I wore that sort of army coat, the green army coat.
Yep,
I got a flea market. Yeah. I wore that a lot.
Not a peacoat, but Vietnam era jacket. Yeah.
And now in my adult life, I dress a lot like Tommy Lee Jones in this film.
I always love
you have a gun fanny pack though.
I like the sweater vest under the sport coat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kimball's outfit that he steals, I really like the one that he takes from the old man, like the big sweater, and I just really, I'm like, that's. It's kind of a stylish old man that he's taking some stuff from there. I mean, that guy came in, you know, looking all right.
Yeah, the 90s. He did okay.
That's why you got to keep it tight, because if I was looking for clothes, I'd be like, this is a little bit tight around the waist. Is there another guy in another room? It's a little bit more portly.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I've developed a theory about filmed cops on the basis of watching this. So there's two primary different film cops that we find. There's the cannoli cop and the donut cop. All right.
Okay. All right. I like where this is going.
Mostly detectives. I'm thinking specifically about a detective, and usually associated with New York City. So usually these detectives are a little greasy, usually leaning toward plain clothes. They're a little bit younger, and they give off the vibe that they could have been gangsters if they had just gone a different direction. It's like they're from the old neighborhood, and some of their friends are in the mafia, but for whatever reason, they decided to go into the force. All right.
So they may not be corrupt, but they're like corrupt adjacent.
They're usually corrupt.
They might turn their head on some certain situation.
Yeah, they're usually corrupt in some way. All right. So that's the cannoli cop, usually associated with New York in the cop universe in film. All right. The donut cop, usually associated with Chicago. These guys are wearing suits. They're a little bit older. They're definitely fatter. They're almost always either like Irish or Scottish. They're very very mustache forward folk.
Except for Pat, the uncle in Cocktail, who was in this as well.
And so the donut cop, these guys are, they may not be like dirty cops. Like they may not take money from a crime scene. But if you kill one of their own, they're going to use every opportunity to take down, you know, whatever cop killer's on the loose. All right.
It's the blue wall type.
Yes, that's right.
And when on your way to the station, you're going to come out with a couple of more bumps and bruises than you went.
All right.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked that there was this like understood element of they think he killed one of theirs. They're going to go after him. It was sort of like the unwritten rules in baseball kind of a thing.
Well, and on top of that, they don't mind saying it out loud. I mean, this is the kind of like public corruption that everyone kind of knows. Like, mm-hmm. You took down a cop. Now we're going to come and hunt you down.
Right.
So that's the kind of cop that I would associate with the donut cop. Right. Now, the donut cop, like I said, usually associated with Chicago, but you would find him in many kind of local areas, too. These are folks that are from like cop families. In other words, their dad were cop or their uncle was a cop. They go to a cop bar. They drink with their cop buddies. That's kind of the culture that they grew up in.
Anthony, right? Are you low key setting up another season of Properly Howard here?
It's possible. It's possible. Donut cops versus cannoli cops.
Well, but don't forget local sheriffs who eat pie at the diner.
I would put that under the donut cop umbrella, although
a subtype.
They're a subtype. They're not. You wouldn't find that guy in Chicago, but that guy grew up in the town, right?
So Copland would have to go into this lineup because that's where you have New York City cops and a sheriff. And mobster, like actual mob stuff, all coming to a head. I think it's Stallone's best role. Absolutely.
Right. I don't know if this theory holds up, but I do associate Copland with the cannoli cop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although there is a little bit of crossover there now that I'm thinking about that.
Because Stallone's character is the sheriff in the town over.
Right. And usually, and I forget who, someone touched on this before. Maybe it was you, Steve. That when the federal agent comes in, they usually have higher end suits. They have better training. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're sort of like
they're slicker.
They come in. They're like, hey, kids, it's fun that you guys were playing cop before. We're gonna take exactly. over this crime scene, and now the big kids are gonna do their thing, right?
Yep.
And this movie does just. Blows out of the water. You start with the donut cops. You see different kinds of donut cops in this film. But then once the federal agents come in, they're almost like geniuses. Like it's like these guys listen to jazz music and like, you know, do impressionist paintings when they go home or something. In addition to their advanced Velcro technology, they're a little bit more bohemian than any kind of federal cop that we've seen before.
Yeah, they have art degrees, all of them.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they're liberal arts into law enforcement. It's a natural transition.
All right, so this brings us into a conversation about Tommy Lee Jones. Now, David, you said something to me via text that I appreciated. You said something along the lines of, can you think of a line that propelled an actor's career better than this one?
I didn't kill my wife. I don't care.
Famously an ad-lib by Tommy Lee Jones. You think that this kind of launched his career.
At first, I need Steve to do the Richard Kimball impersonation of I didn't kill my wife.
I didn't kill my wife.
I don't care.
That's the moment that, you know, the Tommy Lee Jones vibe, right, which we later get in, I think, you know, Men in Black and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That, and then when he opens his waist pack and pulls out his gun, like, that was the moment. And then every line, quip, when he shoots the other felon, everything, and then when he goes to the, I forget his name, Renfro? Or is that the other one? Anyway, the
Cosmo.
The guy, Cosmo.
Yeah.
And he goes, can you hear me? He goes, I don't bargain, or whatever. Like, all of that stuff.
I can't hear anything. My ear is, I can't believe you did that.
You think I should have bargained with that guy?
Yeah. I do. You could have missed. You could have killed me.
Yeah. How bad's that ear?
It's terrible. I'm going to have permanent hearing damage.
Let me see it. Can you hear what I'm saying now?
Yeah.
I don't bargain.
It's a great scene. It establishes almost a fatherly relationship with this guy, and he's also a certain kind of police officer who he's just relentless.
See, I was always more partial to hen house, outhouse, doghouse. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard.
But we don't have any of that unless he says, "I don't care," in the tunnel of the dam.
He's interesting in that, well, he's kind of a revelation in this movie because he has kind of a folksy charm to him. He's already older, right, at this point?
He was in 21 films prior to this.
Right. So
here's the thing that's important about Tommy Lee Jones is he's been around. In fact, 2 years prior, he had been in JFK, which was obviously very, you know, prolific if people knew about this movie, right? He had a bunch of movies that are just kind of like, whatever. But so he had a role in JFK that was pretty significant. Under Siege, and this is where I go back to Under Siege. Under Siege, because of the fact that critics actually liked a Steven Seagal movie, and a lot of it was attributed to the performance by Tommy Lee Jones as the villain. Under Siege really did sort of bring him, like, it. All those people were just suddenly like, Tommy Lee Jones, huh? And then Fugitive comes out, and it's like a year later, and he's able to just capitalize. And from then, it's just off to the races in terms of, I mean, the next year he's in Blown Away, The Client, Natural Born Killers, Blue Sky, and Cop. I mean, that's a lot.
He's in almost every movie after this.
Yeah, then it's Batman Forever, Volcano, Men in Black, U.S. Marshals, a sequel to this one, Small Soldiers, on and on and on. It's amazing how this. It went from like, oh yeah, Tommy Lee Jones has been in movies to now there are Tommy Lee Jones movies.
Right, and you go to a movie because it has Tommy Lee Jones. That is the difference between a movie star and an actor, is that, that actor is their movie. Oh, yeah. I'm going to go see it.
Yeah, we just covered No Country for Old Men.
Did you, and I don't. Wait, is it out yet? You haven't released it.
On Monday.
I think it's all-time top 10 movies for me.
It's fantastic, and I don't think that movie really – I don't think he gets that role
100%.
Unless this movie happens.
100%. And it's such a tonal shift from Men in Black and this.
Yeah, but the one thing that they have in common, this movie and No Country, is folksy charm, but there's, it's like he's the smartest guy in the room.
Right. The wisdom of experience and just like there's something innate, right? Like, so it's like, okay, you can go to the academy, you can do all these different things, but then, you know, it's sort of like the, what you just said about actor versus movie star. It's sort of like, you know, police officer versus, you know, head detective or something along those lines. Right? So he goes like, yeah, you may have, you know, the rules, you know, the procedures, but now how do you execute and perfect it, you know, to bring actual justice.
So here's my thought about the way that he's, I mean, this movie is almost like, for all of the sort of physical action that Harrison Ford is portrayed as doing, it's like all of those acrobats are being juxtaposed with the verbal acrobats of Tommy Lee Jones in this film. He's always talking fast. He's always yelling. He's always shouting over a dam, or, you know, he's always like the best talker in a room full of fast talkers in this film. And Richard Kimball, on the other hand, Harrison Ford, he doesn't have nearly as many lines. When he talks, he usually is like low voice until he yells at the end or whatever. But he's soft-spoken, and he chooses his words very carefully. And what that does, and because we've established kind of Tommy Lee Jones as kind of the fatherly figure who, he doesn't care. He doesn't bargain. He's going to get his man no matter what. He's like a dog with a bone. When he comes around at the end, and he says, "I thought you didn't really care." And he says, "I don't," which is kind of a joke.
Don't tell anybody, okay.
And then it's like everything's going to be okay because Dad finally believes my story. That's the feeling that you get when he's in the car. He's smiling. He takes off the cuffs.
Good, that's such good script writing too, because of the "I don't care" line in the.
It's
damn
so
at the
great.
End.
It's which yeah. which is reiterated on the phone call later on, and right. So if this guy, who's no nonsense, actually it's come around to believe this theory about Provasic, then everyone will. So you don't need any other scenes. And this movie ends perfectly.
I agree. I will take a minor exception to the idea that we've seen Tommy Lee Jones come around to care. I think he does, in the sense that they've had this sort of relationship from afar, and it's like, you know, this is the guy I'm trying to get, so it's like kind of like a hunter prey type thing. But I do think that there's an element of he starts to be more interested in the fact that maybe there's a conspiracy theory, not for Richard Kimball's sake, but for the sake of justice. He's out here, so the man that he was trying to chase changed. He no longer was trying to chase Richard Kimball, the fugitive. He's trying to chase who actually did this thing. So it's like, that's where I think the shift becomes, is that now he's on a hunt. He's on a hunt for truth. And Richard Kimball is sort of a vehicle to that now. So when he says, "I don't care," I think to some degree, he's still being authentic.
And I think this is what's so interesting about the construction of this film. I don't think this film fits in my perfect film category. There's too many nice coincidences, and there's a couple of pacing things. It's a little bit long too, I think. I think you could chop about 15 minutes and still have a really good movie. But the Tommy Lee Jones character, his job is as a federal marshal is to chase down these fugitives, right? He's not a detective. His job is not to solve crime. His job is to bring people back into them, regardless of their guilt or innocence. Yeah. That's not his point of view. But his seek for justice, or he wasn't seeking justice per se, but when confronted with the truth about what was going on, because Kimball saves the guard in the bus, saves the kid in the hospital, you know, and keeps doing all these altruistic things, as he's just Deputy Gerard is just like, wait, this isn't my normal kind of guy that I chase and bring back.
Right.
And who I ultimately am can't turn away from the truth of this injustice.
It could be that. Or it could be that.
Well, if I follow Richard Kimball, I'll get Charles Nichols.
Well, all right. It could be that. Or it could be that he's good at his job because he's good at anticipating what a criminal is going to do next or where he's going to be next.
Absolutely. Right. That's he's a hound dog. He's a bloodhound.
It just so happens that Richard Kimball is trying to solve a mystery. So in order to sort of anticipate where that mystery is going to lead him so he can catch the guy,
exactly,
he's got to now he's now in the position of a detective, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't know. It very well could be that he feels a sense of justice or injustice at the end. I don't know if it necessarily matters that why he's pursuing the end. It just so happens that I think it's important for the audience that he believes that Kimball's innocent at the end. Because you want the audience to believe everything's going to be okay.
Well, and to David's point too, it's like if his whole career and everything he does is anticipating what a criminal is going to be doing on the run, it's like this guy's not on the run. So his ability to catch him is somewhat hampered because this is not a criminal. This is something right. else entirely. So he has to shift his technique. Sure. And so that's the hunt becomes much different. They're not looking for someone to find, you know, well, he's looking for a rock to crawl under. No, he's actually unearthing rocks as we speak. And he's not departing. He's not as far away as we would assume that he would be. And then, yeah, so then the object of why becomes part of it. Whether or not he's looking for some larger form of justice, it's like if they get Charles Nichols, then he really did get the real killer. It's just that wasn't the one he was assigned to.
David, you already touched on this a little bit, but is there a tweak you would make to this movie to improve it?
Yeah, I think I'd cut about 15 minutes
or so. Where are you going to cut? I don't know where you're going to cut. I enjoy every bit of this movie.
So it's roughly a three-act movie, uh-huh. right? There's the whole trial and escape. There's the middle bit, and then there's the end. Once he's figured out the mystery and reveals uh-huh. it, I think you could cut it out of the middle, and all the stuff with there's a big montage scene. There's a bunch of him unraveling the mystery, mm-hmm. and I was doing some. I did a little bit of research on this. The runtime on this was 130 minutes. And that's about 15 to 20 minutes above the average for 1993. So this was a long movie by even its genre or its era standards. I caught myself looking at my phone in the middle in Act mm-hmm. Two during the thing, and I'm like, oh, and when I do that, I'm like, oh, I've lost.
So interest. It's interesting. I think that's a rewatch problem because, I was watching this with my daughter who had never seen the whole thing all the way through. And all of the misdirects were working on her. Like when he's living in the basement and the cops show up.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
She's like, how'd they know to find him there? She's invested because she doesn't know, oh, they're really here to get the slimy drug dealer kid.
Right.
Who's living upstairs, right? But you kind of need that. I mean, that misdirection is sort of a directorial choice, which you might take issue with. But you need that because that drug dealer is going to
finger him.
Yeah, he's going to rat him out, yeah. right? They also do a redirection with the felon who ends up getting shot in the head, right? You think, mm-hmm. Richard Kimball just gets picked up, and then the next scene is Cosmo saying, he's shacking up with a girl, or let's go get him right now, right?
And you think it's Kimball, right. yeah.
So all that stuff, if you have seen it before, doesn't surprise you like it will the very first time.
Sure, yeah.
Steve, is there a tweak you'd make to this movie to improve it?
There's a handful of things that bug me. The dummy. every time, dude. I'm like, if Richard Kimball's leg did what that dummy's leg does in the dam, the movie's over.
I know.
He's not running. It looks, he's dragging
himself. It
looks
like he's like hooking back toward the concrete at one point.
It looks like somebody tried to draw the Air Jordan logo with their left hand. I don't love Ford's interrogation performance. I know that's
just quickly on the dam stuff. Apparently, the budget for just the dam sequence was over $2 million and 150,000 wow. gallons of water.
And a million and a half of that was that dummy, which is weird.
Is all right. Is there
also the fashion show? That's the worst fashion show.
Oh right. Oh God. You see this? Could you cut that? Okay. Could you cut that?
The fashion show in the beginning when they're at the Devlin McGregor. Yeah. The fashion show is so bad. It's just don't have the fashion show in there because the whole time I'm like, God, what? Yeah, use some of that damn budget for the fashion show.
Is there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you appreciated in this movie, Steve?
I'm a sucker for as much as I don't necessarily need the action sequence. Give me a laundry room or like some place where people are just doing their job, especially if they've got headphones in and they don't know what's going on around them. I love that.
David, do you have a trope, a cliche, or device?
The 80s rooftop fight scene and the industrial space cat and mouse I was waiting for I was like, oh, he's going to like fall down on the elevator or he's going to fall off the side and Richard's going to put out his hand and say, take my hand. They subvert all of those tropes. So I like the fact that they use classical templates of the action genre and then they goose it along. They move it along so that you never get a resolution to that. And then you go, oh, this movie's a little bit different. So I like that they use the tropes. They set them up and then they subvert
them. So one of those that I love, and I love it every single time, but just really surprised the hell out of me the first time I watched it, was the criminal calling the cop on the phone and then them realizing, like the cop realizing, oh, this is really him. It's not a fake call. And then everyone scrambles around him in silence to try to like, you know, start up the whatever tracer device that they're using. Which is very very specific to cop movies because, as I'm told, like that's not how real life phone tracers work, and they never work that way. But you've got to stretch out the conversation, and you got.
And you have to do the thing where you snap your fingers and roll
Emily Jones is snapping that. That's how. All right, so
here's I want to play this.
Henry, let me see that phone.
Tell him he looks good in a beard.
I think so.
I think so.
Ask him if he enjoyed
the parade. I hope he was able to wear a little green, sip some whiskey, and enjoy the rest of the
day. Yeah, this is Gerard.
Do you remember what I told you in the tunnel?
We ought to be sipping some whiskey.
See him.
Yeah, I remember. It was noisy. I think you said something like, you didn't kill your wife.
Remember what you told me?
I remember you were pointing my gun at me.
Snapping the fingers.
You said, I don't care.
He's on the south side.
Yeah, Richard, that's right. I don't care. I'm not trying to solve a puzzle here.
Well, I am trying to solve a puzzle.
5 seconds location.
And I just found a big piece.
Richard.
And he slams down the phone.
Richard.
But not hanging up.
Richard. But doesn't hang up. And in every other cop movie I've ever watched, you always know that the criminal is smarter than the cop. Because he hangs up right before they're able to make the trace. And it's like, ah, damn it. Like, he's so smart. He knew just the amount of time to taunt us before he hung up the phone. And this one was a huge surprise because this criminal obviously is very smart. And they use the trope and then they subvert the trope by having him say, nope, I want you to trace this because I want you to come and investigate what I just investigated.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so at this point, you kind of know, okay, Richard Kimball is an amazing investigator. Moreover, he's going to use the federal marshals as a tool to sort of vindicate his own incrimination.
Well, also, I think that goes back to what you were saying, too, and we were talking about, too, in terms of like the turn that Tommy Lee Jones' character does at this point is because he's trying to. He would have anticipated that same exact thing, because he would have assumed this guy. If this guy's a real criminal, he's a smart criminal. Mm-hmm. He's going to hang up before we get a chance to locate him. But he didn't. And at that point, he's like, "Okay, he's not dumb. He did this on purpose.
Yeah,
maybe I'll just like." So now he's entertaining this puzzle solving thing just a little bit more because he's like, "Okay, look, this is the thing. You're defying my expectations.
Yeah.
So
yeah, therefore, he's kind of impressed
I have to recalibrate."
And you know, it's like I'm hunting a different kind of beast than I was before.
all the signals he's getting from Kimball are not the same as any other felon escaped fugitive.
Can I just say we talk about Tommy Lee Jones's lines, and there's so many good ones, but the one that I go back to now more than ever that probably didn't hit me the first couple watches, but I anticipate it every single time I watch it now. It's just, we're eating oranges and we're making IDs. I love that line so much because it is so unnecessary. It is completely unnecessary. But to me, it adds an element of authenticity to this film and just a window into Tommy, like Tommy Lee Jones's folksiness, as well as his, like, hey, I discovered something. Also, here's a detail about oranges.
I like that too. I think that there is something about the acid in the citric acid that dissolves the glue, and I think that you would use that if you were going to doctor an ID.
How do you know a lot about? I guess you watched.
I don't know why I know that. I just know it. All right. Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film? David, you first.
I don't know that Ron Howard could make a film as good as this. I mean, when you go into the camera work, the sets, the train wreck, which is a whole thing in and of itself, you know, the handycam work, the using the parade for real, mm-hmm. like that, you know, using natural lighting, using a lot of French Connection techniques. I don't know that Ron Howard has this kind of edge to his filmmaking. So I think
that's really interesting.
Plus two or plus three.
Yeah. Okay. So you say this is a Howard plus three. I thought this was properly Howard, and I was thinking specifically because, like, if you asked me who directed this movie before I did any research on this, I wouldn't have known. And so it's not like this particular director has a known style, right, or something.
Right.
I think that I think this would sort of be an Apollo 13 kind of thriller.
Maybe a Da Vinci Code in a way.
It's a little bit, I'm not a huge fan of that, but it's both action and cerebral, which I think that Howard can pull off. I don't know if you guys have seen the movie called, I think it's called 13 Lives or 14 Lives.
Don't know it.
Yeah, it's called 13 Lives, and it's a true story about sort of a rescue effort. And just an amazing thriller. I don't know. I thought this was properly Howard. What about you, Steve?
I had properly Howard on my notes as well. And I thought about that a lot throughout the film. I mean, I think, and again, it's like, we're not trying to denigrate Ron Howard in any stretch. If we say like, oh, you know, there were some flaws or there were this or that, but there was sort of this anonymous quality to the director, which, by the way, I was just looking at, he's had a long history, but he made Above the Law, which is Steven Seagal's debut film.
Ron Howard made Above the Law?
No. Andrew Davis. Okay, Andrew
I was
Davis.
Gonna say, and then, wow, I did not know that.
And then following that, Andrew Davis made the movie The Package, starring Gene Hackman and Tommy Lee Jones. I thought that was interesting.
And then
he does Under Siege, where reunites him with both Tommy Lee Jones and Steven Seagal, and then Off to the Future of America. But yeah, so I felt like there was a lot to this movie that was, because it was kind of a well-done cat and mouse, but still playing very heavily with formulas and familiar tropes, but relying heavily on pacing and, you know, not maybe the most amazing sleight of hand, but decent sleight of hand, and getting good performances out of good actors, and in some cases
super
maybe not so
competently
good.
Put together. The whole editing sequence of the efficiency of the trial and the establishing of the mystery at the very beginning, really well done, despite Harrison Ford's acting.
Is there a Kevin Bacon character that could be plausibly inserted into this movie?
Oh, is it plausibly is supposed to be? Oh, shit.
His character is the kid in Hero at Large, could have also been in the hospital with chest pain.
Just making homophobic comments about everyone that walks in.
And, but Kimball saves him anyway to show that what a bigger, you know, big man, hero he really is.
David, do you have a Kevin Bacon character to insert here?
Yeah, I didn't realize that the criteria was plausibly, so I went with Chip Diller from Animal House, who's the he's a pledge to the fraternity. And he's the one in the military uniform at the end where it gets flattened as everybody's rioting. And I was thinking he could be the odd man out on Gerard's team, always quoting regulations to him and saying, oh, we got to wait for backup. And then Gerard kicks in the door and, you know, that kind of stuff.
So I don't know if you've seen Whitewater Summer. Bacon plays sort of a camp leader named Vic, who sort of aggressively knowledgeable about Boy Scout stuff. And if you've not seen this movie, it's actually a pretty good movie, but I was worried the entire time that he was a pedophile. I thought, what is he going to turn into?
That's always the worry with him, isn't it?
It's like, you're a Boy Scout leader. You've got these boys out in the wilderness. When is this going to turn into that kind of movie? And it doesn't. And it's a good movie, but I thought that if you inserted Vic from Whitewater Summer, maybe he could help Harrison Ford out of the river at some point. Mm. All right. Rather than Half the Battle, One to Grow On, I'm going to play one of my favorite John Mulaney bits.
So I went with my mom as her date to reconnect with Governor Bill Clinton. We walked into the ballroom. It was a big hotel ballroom. It was the Palmer House Hilton, big Hilton hotel ballroom. Walked into the ballroom, it was packed with people. It's actually, it's the ballroom from the end of the movie, The Fugitive. Remember? So, that ballroom. So, my mom and I walk in, it's packed with people. The end where Harrison Ford as Dr. Richard Kimball bursts in to confront Dr. Charles Nichols, right? Okay, so, that ballroom. So, my mom and I walk in, it's packed with people. Why does Kimball confront Nichols? Well, I know we all know this, but Kimball, he found out that Nichols, along with Devlin McGregor and Lentz, who's mysteriously died, they had hired Frederick Sykes, the one-armed man, to kill Kimball. Kimball's wife wasn't even the target, I know we all know this, but they were gonna kill Kimball because he wasn't gonna approve certain liver samples to pass RUD-90. So Kimball finds out about all of this, and of course he's furious, and he bursts in the ballroom and he goes, you switch the samples! And Dr. Nichols is like, lady said, gentlemen, my friend Dr. Richard Kimball. What accent did that guy have, by the way? He goes, you switched the samples and you doctored your research so that you could have Provasic. Anyway, so it's that ballroom. So we walk into that ballroom. It was packed with people. It was packed with people. A real who's not of Chicago celebrities.
I love this bit. There are no, like, obvious punchlines. It just presupposes that you've seen this movie and you appreciate it for all of its quirks.
Yeah, and it makes almost like, is this funny? You know, is this like, because the movie does take itself
pretty seriously. Yeah.
But there are, like, I do quote a lot of this movie sometimes for the unintentional comedy. And to me, you know, because I saw Mulaney do this bit in Berkeley at the Greek Theater, and I was blown away because I was like, ah, it's Provasic.
it's so particular. It could be viewed as kind of like a 1% kind of humor, and it does presuppose a certain that you're of a certain age or something.
Yeah, I think the age is part of it, right?
But the people who are laughing really, really hard, because for whatever reason, we all know that this is kind of funny on some level.
Is part of the joke too that you're trying to find the joke and he keeps going further and further into detail?
You know, it's sort of a cutout. He's kind of like, right. I'm telling you this other story. By the way, I was in the same hotel that movie was shot in, and then you're kind of along with the ride. You're like, right. Okay, there's a sidecar now, And he's more interested in the sidecar than he is in the actual vehicle that's driving the joke. And that's kind of a fun
right,
ride,
he gets
too.
He all nerdy about it, yeah.
Well, it's kind of like when you and I went to New York and I really wanted to go to, like, the touristy places we wanted to go to, or at least I wanted to go to, were maybe a little less conventional. Like, I wanted to go to the court. House area, because that's where the picture of the court from Night Court was in the opening sequence. Mm-hmm. And we ended up having like a wonderful time there. Like,
it was a lovely time. That was the same day that we visited the firehouse from Ghostbusters. I love this movie, and the fact that I named it as a properly Howard movie just kind of shows you how amazing Howard can be at times, even though he's exactly. not associated with this movie at all.
Yes, this is a compliment to Ron Howard, who, by the way, had a guest spot on one of the episodes of the Fugitive series.
Oh, interesting.
Very interesting.
Kurt Russell had two shows, though. He had a two-show arc.
So we're not doing Half the Battle?
Let's do it. David, is there a Half the Battle Wonder yes. moment in this film?
When you're flying in an aircraft and you're a law enforcement officer, you must absolutely
position the microphone so that you get great distortion when you're giving all your orders.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.